Contenders, ready! Gladiators, ready! 3, 2, 1!
The Gladiators!
Hello and welcome to the first episode of Series 2, yay, of the GladPod. In association with Gladiators TV, I'm David Blackmore, and back for Series 2, everyone's favourite gladiator, it's Jet!
Thank you. Thank you. I don't know about that, but thank you. I'll take that for now. Welcome back, everybody.
Yeah, and of course, producer Paul, you're back. Thank you very much, Paul, for your support and getting this second series off the ground.
No problem. Glad to be back. I think the response to Series 1 was so overwhelming. It's gone down really well, so really glad to be back for Series 2 and hopefully some amazing guests ahead of us.
Yeah, and I know that you've been working so hard to get list of guests for Series 2 that is going to rival kind of Series 1, because when you look at it, you set yourself a high bar to try and beat that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, luckily, there are still a lot of big personalities on the list to get through. So we're definitely not short of people. I think the struggle has been, obviously, with what's been going on in the world, is obviously just getting people at the right time to all match up, to just have that time to talk and reminisce about everything, really. So hopefully I've got a few big names in the bag, a few more penciled in that are hopefully going to come off. Looking forward to what's ahead of us in Series 2.
Di, Series 1, I mean, we both went into it with not knowing what was going to come out from Series 1, not knowing the stories we were going to hear. And I think what we found was just 12 fantastic episodes. And we set out on this journey to learn more about the gladiators before their life as a gladiator, during and afterwards, and also just a bit about them personally. And you know, I think we achieved that.
I think so. It was like a rebonding session on meeting every single one of them. And what was so lovely is every single person that came, and we could be in the studio. It was fantastic. Big hugs all around as they were leaving. And every single one said, got so many more stories, I'd love to come back. And you know, it's just people's lives. I mean, it's just huge, and it is a privilege to kind of sit and immerse yourself in someone's world for an hour and give them that chance and that platform, because there are so many layers to people, aren't they? And we think, oh, Gladiator must have been into fitness or body, but actually we've found out so much more about everybody. So again, anyone listening to this, if you've still got more questions, you can contact us, because keep them coming. There's just layers and layers to everybody.
Yeah, you're right. And actually, a lot of these gladiators, I think I would love to see, and as you said in all of them, and rightly so, that we do need to try and get them back in some shape or form. And so if you have got questions that we didn't ask, because, you know, producer Paul and his notes are so in depth, there's so much to cover. And obviously, when someone's telling a story, you know, some of those stories are like, you know, 5 to 10 minute stories, because they tell them so well. And you just can't get, you physically can't get through everything. I think there were a few times that we finished episodes and you'd go, you know, because for me, I kind of cross off things as we're ticking through, going through them. And, you know, you'd see things that we've had to skip to get onto the next subject, or it's the tangent has naturally gone onto the next section. And you just think, oh, there's so much more to talk with all of them. But what I've loved the most for me is, you know, Helen, Panther, Vogue, Susie, and Rebel Jennifer. After coming on the show, they now follow me on social media, and whenever I'm posting stuff on there, they're like my hype girls now. They're like, you're smashing it, David. It's great, David. And just like, before this all happened, I didn't have these gladiators in my life, and it's a great feeling. And the thing to, I know that, Di, you just mentioned it as well, that the thing to make clear is that when we did a lot of the first series chat, it was before COVID restrictions had come in. So we were in a studio, we were able to be close together. And actually, you know, the second series has presented some challenges for us, because we're now having to do, you know, everything over Zoom rather than in a studio. And obviously the difficulties you have with that is that everyone's got different backgrounds and noises and everything along those lines. We've had to sort out all the technology for it, and obviously with the guests that we're hoping to speak to, we're currently having to try and work out what's going to be the best way for them to record their audio as well. Sometimes, you know, we're probably going to have to just perhaps record the Zoom call itself. But I think the one thing that we've learned from this past year, and the one thing that actually helped, I think, us with Series 2, we were able to think a bit more outside the box. And I think that the only clue that I'm going to give to people is that we were able to sort of broaden our horizons outside of the UK. And that is one thing that technology can do. And I'm excited about some of the chats that we have at this stage, touch wood, got lined up. However, Paul and I were thinking, how are we going to start our Series 2? You know, we obviously wanted to come back fresh from such a great Series 1 where we've had so much fantastic comments from everyone on social media, but also into our GladPod email inbox. And I should add that there's been so many of you that have written into us, and we will get through all of the correspondence that we've had in. But Paul and I were just talking about how we'd like to start Series 2. And actually, Paul said, and it's a very valid point, you know, when we started the series, and Di and I, we just sat down and we just recorded a bit, essentially a pilot, and then kind of the full episode, there's just so much to get through with all the gladiators, and we just didn't have enough time to get through all of that. And Paul was like, you know, I was listening to your chat with Jet, and just there's just so much more to talk about. So we're kind of practicing what we're preaching, really, in the sense that we're saying to ourselves, right, well, Di says at the end of each episode, we'd love to have you back. So Di, we're having you back.
Thanks.
So I'm not sure how you feel about that, because, you know, you're not going to have kind of the David Blackmore line of questioning now. You're going to have the Oracle, Paul Noddings, with his question.
Cool. I'm up for that.
Because, Paul, when we looked through the notes, there was so much that we just weren't able to cover the first time around, wasn't there?
Oh, massively, yeah. There were definitely moments from episode one where we wanted to delve a little bit deeper to find out those little nuggets of information that, like Diane said in previous chats, until you're talking about it, there's so much after that you suddenly remember. I'm going to use this episode of the Glad Pod to really sweep up everything we missed previously and really find out more about the person behind Jet. There was one piece of kind of nostalgia back in the day, which was a VHS of Jet, a video profile. And that was my inspiration for this episode of Jet Revisited, is to kind of use some of that information and add layers on top of it. So I hope you're ready, Diane.
I'm cringing already.
3, 2, 1.
So, Paul, where would you like to start? Where was the place that first came to your mind in terms of where you wanted to begin with?
Well, actually, before we get stuck in, I just quickly wanted to get Diane's thoughts on nostalgia and why it can be so important for people, especially during the crazy times of the pandemic. And I'm guilty of this myself. I often look back to things of my childhood, like Gladiators, with such fondness, and I've obviously carried this through into my adult life. Diane, with your like expertise in psychology, why do you think people find comfort in things such as Gladiators?
I guess it comes back to connection. And how I work as a psychotherapist, I'll sit and listen to the person, the whole person, but there's kind of facets and aspects of all of us, like sub-personas, parts of ourselves, sub-personalities. And the biggest one that we all invariably, not always, of course, hark back to the halcyon days of when life was that much more simple, usually when you're a child or a teenager, at impressionable kind of ages and stages, depending what your hormones are doing. So you look at a show like GLADS and look at the anchors, the amount of anchors that anyone can throw onto the memory of what, nearly 30 years ago, how old you'd have been, where you'd have been, what house you were living in at the time, who did you have around you that made Saturday night so important to watch, usually as a family. And that's why it's so deeply embedded to probably a time for most people when life was just that much more simple.
There's been so many people that have been tagging us in posts that are like, I've introduced my kids during lockdown to Gladiators or revisited it, because they've, like you say, been looking for that nostalgia element to kind of, I suppose, have that safety net and a bit of comfort, like you said, to kind of happier times and something that's quite comforting for them as well.
Absolutely. I love the way you did like a self-embrace as well there. Oh, I'm going to give you a big hug, Paul, when I do get a chance to see you. And I think that's what it was like, a hug in a program, really. Even though it was combative, you fell in love with the Gladiators to a degree, but also the Contenders, and the fact that they would screen always to the families sat in the audience, and just how much you got involved with the contender's journey as such, to use that word. And it was just a really wholesome, full family show. And I guess they try and do versions of it with different things like talent type shows to this day. But there was something very, very honest about Glads. None of us could hide and not be good, because you were nowhere to hide in your lycra if you were crap at any of the events. But so, yeah, it was nails and a hug in a very small bit of lycra.
Tonight, 6:10, witness the awesome power of... Will it be no more Mr. Nice Guy for the Wolfman? And will he emerge from the shadow of defeat? They can take the knocks. Can you take the pace? Gladiators tonight, 6:10.
Okay, so I thought it'd be quite nice to go all the way back to the very start, before Gladiators. I suppose to kind of go a little bit deep was that you viewed yourself as kind of, in your words from the video, ugly masculine girl, which led on to eating disorder bulimia between the ages of 14 and 19. And this is a subject that's come up, and I kind of wanted to raise it on the Glad Pod because quite a lot of people, a lot of the fans have been emailing in asking for advice about body confidence, self-image, and kind of wanted to know your story, because obviously whilst you were going through that, you moved to London at the age of 16, which is like a massive step for somebody so young to come from a small northeast town. And I kind of know that myself, but I did it a lot later on in life. And you kind of moved to London to join the London School of Contemporary Dance. Can you take us back to that kind of time in your life and just kind of let us know what was going on with you back then?
Gosh, it is going way, way back. So we're talking about 84. Do I have to put a date on it? Well, I was about 14. Prior to that, from the age of about 7 to 13, 14, I was a gymnast. And a little bit like Lightning, Kim and Susie, Vogue. I was also in the GB squad, so I was competing at a really high level. So my physicality, my ability to then grow up and become a gladiator was already kind of set. And I do think the gladiator arena really loaned itself quite well to those who are ex-gymnasts. So I was a gymnast, but always, all the way through my gym career, and it was a career because obviously you're training at high level and it becomes your life. I loved making up the dance routines, the floor routines for all the other gymnasts. And I just absolutely loved music. I'd started playing music from a really early age, very badly, on my violin. I could still play the flute though, but I just love classical music. My father used to sing amazing opera. He had a gorgeous tenor voice, and my brother is still writing prog rock, brilliant music to this day. So I had prog rock in one corner, my dad singing opera in another, and I just like classical music and anything I could play on my recorder or my flute or my violin. Was in orchestras and stuff. So my ability to move well and love music just naturally evolved into this. And I still can do it. I can listen to music and I can see whole ballets, whole works. And they call it synesthesia, don't they? When you're putting different parts of your senses together. And I suppose that's a dancer and that's a choreographer. And it's still a massive part of my soul. So I auditioned at the age of 16 for London Contemporary, Rombert and Laban. And the time, London Contemporary Dance Theatre, the company themselves, were doing amazing works. And I got accepted and so moved down at 16. And it was young. If anyone said to me, my 16-year-old daughter's going to move to London, I'd be like, yikes. But I was so in love and I was so mature for my age as well, but so in love with dance and choreography. It was an absolute no-brainer. And it was in the day when you could get an arts grant as well. So I got kind of partial funding to start helping support me for my studies. So I moved to London at 16 and never came back to the northeast to live full time until helping care for my mum in these latter years. So yeah, amazing. That's how it all started.
I hope you don't mind me asking, but like, it was something that was quite spoken about when you were a gladiator in a lot of the kind of the interviews and video profiles that the producers used to put together to, I suppose, introduce the gladiators to the fans and let them know kind of more about them, was that you did suffer from an eating disorder, and it kind of, looking at the dates, it would have been probably like when you moved to London as well. How did that conversation come up with Nigel and Ken about you revealing that you kind of suffered with an eating disorder? Because I'm not sure if a lot lot of the fans nowadays will remember or would have really taken that in, but it was something that definitely stood out to me when I was a fan back in the day of hearing you talk about it and realizing, oh wow, there is such a thing as eating disorders going on. So yeah, what was the conversation between the producers and yourself to decide to divulge that to the rest of the world?
Do you know what it was? We had a head of press office at the time, was a lady called Zoe McIntyre, a fabulous, larger than life lady, big warm character. And she, as once we'd all been selected as GLADs, she said one thing to us all, I think. I remember her saying it to me, but I think everybody had got the kind of note about it. If you've got any skeletons in the closet, if you've got any stories, any personal stories, take ownership of them and get it out there, type of thing. So I was set up with a journalist, news journalist, to do a feature on it, because I think our late Princess Diana had also, during that time, late 80s, early 90s, come clean about she'd suffered for many years with a body dysmorphia. She obviously, the symptomology of that for her was food, and often food, alcohol, drugs, any of these things, they're just the symptoms of what's beneath the surface. And I had, you're quite right, Paul, thanks for reminding me, because I have to really think back. I hated the way I looked because I was very muscular for a young dancer, and dancers are very muscular people, but for me, I wanted to be like super, super thin. So coming out of the 80s into the early 90s, there was that kind of Kate Moss, having virtually no flesh on your bones, being really androgynous looking. And for me, that would have been, I would have loved to have been that way, but I ended up like this, with all the curves in the wrong and the right places. And I was really muscular and really curvy. And it was my then partner at the time, who I was with for a good 5 years, my first long-term partner, bless him. He said, you know, Di, I'm going to take you somewhere where women would take things to look like you. I'm going like, what? What do you mean? And he took me to a bodybuilder gym, and there was these girls just, you know, pushing weights and getting really fit to stand in a bikini on stage and show their muscles off. And he said, you've got it naturally. He said, can't you see the value in just how you're put together is absolutely perfect? And little was I to then know that actually becoming a gladiator kind of was the epitome of that. It's, if I hadn't been this sort of athletically shaped, naturally dynamic athlete, because gymnastics had created that foundation, then of dance, I kept all my skills level up, being able to do all the flips and the somersaults you still see. What you saw in the gladiatorial arena, it all kind of came together and made sense. But I felt it was really important to talk out about how, you know, our relationship with food is often a barometer for how we are within ourselves and what's going on. If there's a lot of pressure from the outside in to feel like you've got to look a certain way that doesn't fit what you see in the mirror, then something's going to give there. There's going to be a kind of a dissonance. And hopefully it doesn't turn into an eating disorder, because I know a lot of guys who've been listening to our Fab Glad pods have written in very bravely saying, you know, GLADs helped me accept what I was and how I became and body image stuff. And I love that. And I think that, you know, all of us as a whole team, girls and boys, went on to kind of create some positive images about being athletes, being functional athletes at that, and having fun with, you know, with how you are rather than trying to be something you're not. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, Di. It really does. The only thing, whenever people put things in terms of dates of when things started and when things ended, it always leads me to think of a question is, can you pinpoint a moment where you were like, when looking back now, you're like, okay, that's where it started. Was it a comment? You often find, with these, especially with eating disorders, that there'll be a comment that someone has made, most likely at school, that you can look back and pinpoint, well, actually, that was the start of it. And also, you're talking about, you know, 14 to then say 19, was there a moment where you woke up one day and you're like, I think I'm over it now?
Two really good questions in there. Yes, the moment I felt horrified and there was two things around about that period. I'd started to develop chesticles. And for me, the perfect gymnasts were tiny and what I call underdeveloped. They weren't showing characteristics of becoming an adult woman. So I used to get these huge thick bandages because I'd broken my ankle quite badly. at one point training as an elite gymnast, and I kept the bandages. They were quite deep bandages and very long, and I would bite my chest on going to sleep at night, hoping it would suppress. Absolutely mechanically wrong. Hormones are going to do this anyway, but my little brain at the time was just sort of desperate to try anything. And I remember, because I was at the end of the tumble run, so in gymnastics, all the big tumbles that you see on the floor exercises, you have to work up separately, and we had this brilliant tumble strip at the gym up in the South Tyneside area, the northeast of England, and it was a beautiful sprung run with a big pit at the end, so you could start throwing really dangerous moves without having to be spotted by a coach or someone to catch you. And there was I think one of the seniors, I was still a junior gymnast because it goes about age, tapped me on the shoulder and she said, "Oh gosh, you're developing a really beautiful figure." And that will haunt me, and that stayed with me, because it's quite a personal thing to remark to anybody. There I am, just on the verge of puberty, and there's another person saying, "You've got a gorgeous figure." And I could, I mean, it'd be a lovely compliment now, wouldn't it? Anybody. I equated the word figure with feminine and female, and I just had a resistance to it, because to me, that could start spelling the end of my career as a gymnast. And I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready to start thinking, "Oh my gosh, I'm nearly 5'6", my full adult height. If I develop chest and bottom and my weight changes, I can't throw all the dangerous moves anymore. My career's going to be over," because gymnastics was everything. And I'm sure any young athletes or any parents out there who've got young dancers and gymnasts as children might really see that as well, this obsession. But to be honest though, obsession is what makes you really great and good at what you do. You have to be totally committed, and I wasn't ready for puberty. So yes, and I also remember the time that your second question is excellent, when I thought I can get through this and over this, because that partner, my first long-term partner, bless him, really did help me to kind of look in the mirror and go, "Actually, I'm really okay as I am." This is pre-Gladiators. So just before Gladiators, by about 2 or 3 years, I'd started eating normally, whatever normal is for some people. And my relationship with food had started to change, because I went and got the education as well, because I still teach in health and fitness. I started learning about what real nutrition is, rather than what my fantasy of a brain was, a black coffee, a Kit Kat or an apple per day, you know, nothing, no nutritional, no calorific value at all for my body. So I actually started to learn. I think it was Muscle and Fitness magazine was often laying around from this chap, and they had really good articles on good nutrition. So I started kind of teaching myself, and then eventually went on to lots of courses, to which this day I'm a holistic lifestyle qualified by Paul Check, who's one of the world's innovative, amazing strength and conditioning specialist, nutritionist. He's just brilliant. A guy called Paul Check, check him out. He does brilliant videos and stuff, but his knowledge is superb. So it started me on that journey, which to this day I fully embrace, no matter what line of work I'm doing.
I've got to say, as a teenager, I'm a little bit older than that now. I've just gone 23. I had a lot of problems. I looked in the mirror and saw a very ugly, masculine, girly. And for years I wrestled with that. Only through proper education, proper eating habits, and looking after myself, and then it's taken about 4 years for me to, you know, look after myself.
And then after overcoming your eating disorder, like you mentioned, you went on to win a figure fitness competition, which is how you were spotted by the producers of Gladiators, as you were featured in Bodybuilder Monthly magazine, and they were obviously scouring through to find potential gladiators for the very first series. How did the whole idea of competing in a figure fitness competition come along, especially as it is quite a shift away from dance and gymnastics? I know that there are many different categories within bodybuilding, but what made you want to enter a figure fitness competition?
It was that the chap I've just mentioned before, he was the one who said, "Listen, let's set you a goal. How about doing that?" And I thought, oh, the performance element I could do in my sleep, because I'd been performing and doing stuff, you know, in Lycra on a stage from a very early age, I suppose you could argue. And I think there was just the kind of, yes, I wanted to, it was a goal that I could set myself. And there were some brilliant female Americans at the time in these bodybuilding magazines, a lady called Gladys Portuguese, Rachel McLish. If you can ever look at, and these women were just beautiful. They had the physique of being built, because they're obviously very muscular, but they were still very, very pretty, very feminine. And I think they performed nicely too. So they kind of, I kind of could recognise something in them, in me, which didn't make me feel, as you said from one of the other questions, I felt very ugly and very masculine because of my muscles from an early age. And I would get comments, oh, look at your muscles, all the way through school and stuff. But it's like I say to many people, what's your USP? The one thing that might make you feel awkward or different or not worth in any way might be that one thing that makes you stand out. So I kind of went with it. And that's what I did. And I'll never forget that. Yeah, it was a good routine. I got myself nicely cut, I think. I don't think I ever reached that good condition when I gladiated years later. But initially they wanted a lot of the girls to be much like curvy muscle, you know, quite full in the muscle. And I was never going to be that. I couldn't get any bigger than I was.
So, Di, what would your advice be to someone who may be suffering from maybe self-esteem issues or low body confidence issues?
I think you've got to ask yourself why you feel you're valuing yourself on how you physically look, because we're so much more a huge sum of the whole part is a huge sum of many things. And if there's that little part inside of you which is putting so much value and worth, and there's two clues in there, two big clues, into just simply how you look, either, you know, you've got to be asking some deeper questions as to why that's so important to you. Because I'm sure if you think inside of yourself, if you're one of these people that is obsessed with how you look, ask yourself, is that what I like about other people? Do you like certain people in your life because they're lovely people, they're inspirational, they're courageous, or they've got a brilliant brain? Not just do you like that person because they look a certain way. Because if you are one of these people who is valuing other people by how they, just simply by the way they look, you're probably doing that for yourself. And you need to have a little chat with yourself and think, okay, I find value and worth in others because of what they bring to my life as a person. It's nice if they're dressed up nicely. It's nice if someone does look good. But ask yourself, if you're really valuing others, as a clue in that, with just simply how they look, you're probably doing the same to yourself. And I think might be best, I can't say for sure, but talk to somebody. I mean, I'm a trained psychotherapist, and if somebody came to me who was just physically obsessed with them only feeling worth in the world because of their body fat level, I'd be doing some much deeper work with that person for them to find other things of value and worth in life. And that's a very, very personal thing. I think sometimes you need to have a few years under your belt. Hence why eating disorders tend to affect quite young or youngish people, because you're still evolving. You're still growing and finding different points of worth and reference on your journey through life. And it will change as our values change, very rarely, but your values tend to change when you become a parent for the first time, or you lose somebody you love to a serious illness. Values will take a big shift. And I think life then starts to hold bigger and deeper meaning than simply your body fat level.
I got better from an eating disorder. And I just want to say, you can do it. And life is what you make it. Keep it broad. Keep it general. No one owes you anything. No one's going to put it in front of you. You make it, no matter what. And don't place too much importance on one thing.
So then, moving on slightly into the 90s, you've won the figure fitness competition, been spotted. Obviously, in the previous episode, we discussed kind of the tryout for Gladiators and how you became Jet, which, if you've not heard that episode, I thoroughly recommend you go back and listen to Diane's first episode on the Glad Pod. But I wanted to touch upon girl power of the 90s, because a lot of time people talk about the Spice Girls, which was obviously a massive phenomenon around the world. But before the Spice Girls, we had the female gladiators. And to a lot of people, you were role models and icons, and nowadays have that legend status of kind of, you did mean a lot to a lot of people back then and still to this present day. So how does it feel like to know that you have inspired a lot of people from your time back in the 90s, I suppose?
Oh, it's an odd one. I'm sort of trying to search and make that connection in my own sort of heart and head and memory, and what that would feel like to now be aware that, yeah, like the Spice Girls, was there something impact, because I was on the receiving end of it. I was just that person. Was there something empowering about girls watching the girls come out, say when we came out from the back of the arena onto the shop floor to We Are Family? I mean, that just was quite iconic in terms of that sort of strong women all tumbling out or running out into the arena. and feeling proud. I used to be honest, I used to feel really nervous always in the gladiatorial arena. A lot of the flicks and the somersaults and the hair flicking wasn't just for show. It was nervousness. Just keep moving. And maybe the camera won't, because I was slightly kind of, oh God, if I stand still, the camera's going to pick up on all the lumps and bumps in the wrong and the right place. I still had the mentality of somebody who had a bit of body dysmorphia or an eating disorder, but the symptoms had started to go because I was embracing healthy eating, looking after myself, educating myself more about the issue and about nutrition and well-being. But as far as an icon goes, I have actually, as a girl, I team teach. I do a little bit of team teaching dance, call it Zumba. So influences of dance from music across the world. And I just love it. I'm still always going to be a dancer in my soul. And I team teach with this amazing woman. She's mid-30s. And I have permission to speak about, she had a terrible upbringing at some point with a close member of the family. She used to sit and watch with the whole family, and she saw me, because I turned up in a Zumba class one day, and she's like, no, I can't believe it. I was her idol, because she thought, there's a very strong, positive woman, a role model to show that a woman can have strength and power and beauty and has the right to say yes and no to the world. And it apparently gave her a sense of core strength to kind of, yeah, be strong about what she was having to endure as a young woman. I can't go into too much more detail, but to know that and then see it at close quarters and this confident, brilliant woman doing what she does now, thinking, gosh, did I have any influence on that? And I think because we did, with the press office, we did do some articles, and I was quite happy to talk about, you know, coming back from an eating disorder or anything else. You know, sometimes conflict can be with somebody outside of you, or you can be internally conflicted with. Remember, I mentioned about the parts of the self. We can all go through phases in life whereby we might not like ourselves so much for whatever reason. So, yeah, you can get through and you can become whole and you can have a really great life, but it's about choices, isn't it?
How did you cope with all of the attention that you received? Because, like, obviously you were on the most popular program of the 90s. Everyone had an opinion about it, whether it was good or bad. You were one of the main stars of the show. Obviously, it was very different back in the day of, obviously, you didn't have social media and things like that. But how did you cope with, like you say, the press attention, the fan attention?
Probably quite badly, actually. I would walk around with a baseball cap on, still do, and not be comfortable with the attention. It was just, for me, it's another job, just a lot more people were watching it than the job I would do daily, which would be teaching in a studio somewhere. And I found it a little bit uncomfortable. I know some of the other glads really enjoyed the fame. They enjoyed knowing that people were looking at them and going, oh, is that so-and-so off TV? I found it really intrusive. And I think the thing is, you know, if we had social media around like we have today, back then, probably would have been a hot mess, to be honest. My mum used to help me with the fan club, the fan mail from the fan club. We used to literally get letters and pictures and wonderful things in the day when you got proper post, not just stuff on social media.
I was going to say, I rewatched your VHS tape that I mentioned earlier, a Jet Video Profile, as it was pitched, See the Girl Behind Jet. And they featured your lovely mum, Pat, who I've met on many occasions. And she was on there talking about how she would go shopping with a list and come back with absolutely nothing except a list of people she had to get autographs for. Then your dad, again, a really lovely man, how he would go out and he was just known as Mr. Jet or Jet's dad. So I guess it's the attention that your fame then brought onto your family and how they also had to deal with it.
It's odd, isn't it? Because my family are really super talented. My dad was a very well-known astronomer up here in the northeast of England. A fabulous opera singer in his own right as well. And just a really good all-round guy. My brother, albums and albums worth of brilliant prog rock music. Sister, talented artist, just brilliant with nature and everything. And my mum sort of sat in the middle of all these kind of really talented people doing all these things. And suddenly Jet out, just it was just all about Jet. And so I felt slightly sorry for the family that they'd kind of to this day carry something that I guess just because more people knew about it, that's all. But yeah, I felt a bit for them at the time.
The effect on her was obvious, but what about the rest of her family?
The effect it's had on my life, and I think I could speak here for Pat as well, is that obviously we have suddenly... Isn't it a strange thing how suddenly the father of the child, you get something like, ah, well, of course, this, that's Mr. Jet. You say, oh, that's Jet's dad. So my claim to fame these days, of course, is almost through that thing itself. I suppose it's had a... It's a rather a warming effect, really. It's rather nice for somebody to sort of nudge, nudge, wink, wink. You know who that is. Even when I'm lecturing now, I go out still lecturing. I'm consulting on health and safety work. I go into a lecture room and, of course, somebody in there is going to say, well, the first thing you got to know about this guy is, of course, he's Jet's dad. So when you say, of course, what effect it has on you, I suppose it has that effect. That you become a little more popular. I don't mind that. I can live with that. But I confess it. We do like a bit of privacy, and the only difficulty that we've got to cope with is, of course, the dear old telephone and other people knocking on the door, wanting the autographs and the usual thing. But, yeah.
And they ask me, oh, my little grandchildren would love your daughter's autographs, picture in that. So it's affected me a lot because I come home instead with just my shopping list and a few bits and pieces, which I haven't got all my shopping together because I've got to get home. Unfortunately, I've got lists to get this one's autograph, you know, and lists for a... So it has affected us quite a bit, I must admit. But we do our best for her.
And obviously with the fame came a lot of merchandise and memorabilia that was also released for Gladiators, most of it which I own. But how did it feel seeing your face on all of this merch that was absolutely everywhere and covered everything from action figures to yogurt pots, stationery sets, duvet covers? And you and Wolf were probably the main two gladiators that were predominantly featured. How did that feel to you to be singled out? And were you aware of how the other gladiators felt about you being the main one on all of the merchandise?
Do you know, I don't know. I can't speak for the others, really. And I know it's not what you wanted to hear. But was there animosity or jealousy? I don't know. I didn't feel comfortable about having people come up to me with something with me on it because I'm like, oh my God, where did you get that from? The duvet set, you know, sleeping with your head on Jet's pillow, you know. There is actually one in a wardrobe here somewhere where my late father. So I do have a box of memorabilia still with some bits and bobs in, but I was always quite shocked with what, you know, you'd be doing a signing and suddenly this sort of calendar or a pop model or a keyring or something would just sort of rock up in front of you. And you'd be like, where did you get this from? And yeah, I mean, it was a huge machine, wasn't it? So I suppose one of the ways that ITV and LWT at the time could make more money from it would be merchandising. Of which Paul has it all.
Well, yeah, the merchandise was on the scale of like a Hollywood blockbuster movie. And I guess that was like over multiple years as well, because it wasn't just like one Christmas Gladiators was in. It was like over probably the first 5 years of the show had so much merchandise released. And I feel sorry for my poor parents who had to buy it all for me, to be fair.
Is the attic still up at your parents? Is it buckled?
They keep telling me, oh, Paul, when are you going to put this stuff on eBay? And I just, yeah, feels weird, doesn't it? It's that nostalgia element to it again. It's kind of like, oh, it's quite nice knowing it's there, but obviously don't have it on display and stuff. But do you have a favourite piece of merchandise? I know you said some of it was a little bit weird, and it must be weird seeing yourself on like all of this yogurt pots and action figures and stuff like that. Was there anything that you saw that you thought, oh, actually, that's quite nice?
Do you know what? Actually, in the room that I stay in when I'm visiting up here to help care for my mum, I'm in my late father's bedroom when I'm here, and it just feels really moving to sort of still feel that I'm close to him all these years on since we lost him. On the wall in this room is a clock. it's a gladiator picture with a clock, and it works, and so I can wake up and go, oh, there we all are. It's 7:30. And I said, Mum, has the battery ever been changed? Because I thought, God, it's still going after all these years. Naive. She says, no, I keep changing the battery. So she keeps stoking the life back into it. But yeah, I love it because I think they had it up when Dad was still with us. And it's the only thing I'm probably bear to look at, to be honest.
If you want to be part of the action, you'll need one of my 6 Gladiators Metallic Action Cards. There's the awesome Jet, the powerful powerful Shadow and the Mighty Wolf. Free on special packs of Kellogg's Frosties. They're great.
The only other thing I wanted to pick up, though, something you talked about earlier, was sort of audio attention. How did you feel about things, I don't know, like the wolf whistles or the cat calling? You know, were there any moments that you were particularly uncomfortable?
I can't remember. Mind you, I have a menopause brain, so a lot I can't remember some days. I don't think I actually tuned. I think I think a lot of the other guys as well, pretty much during Gladiators, the last couple of years in particular, I was sort of always settled in a long-term relationship. So I never, you know, when you're in a long-term, very happy, married, settled, long-term relationships, you tend not to, well, I didn't tend not to kind of tune in to what's going on outside, whether who's looking at me or for what reason, I would never know. And I'm still a bit like that, still kind of walk around half blind. I don't know. I think the guys in particular would have got a lot of attention because they were just so obviously huge and beautiful looking men. I think girls, we could get away with just hiding ourselves. I did. I'm still not comfortable. I would never be that comfortable with it. It's beauty's in the eye of the beholder.
And also talking about, obviously saying that you're in relationships during a lot of time in the show, there was one relationship with fellow gladiator, I hope you don't mind me mentioning, Hunter, that you had during the show, and it was kind of one of those big celebrity kind of romances that was all over the newspapers. How was it like having a relationship and kind of talking to the producers, like when you were on this big massive hit show and it's two of probably the biggest stars? Like, did you have to sit down with Nigel and explain something's going on here? Like, how do we approach it? Like, how did it all kind of come about?
I don't think we did. I don't think we had to kind of make a declaration or sit with any of the producers and say, how do we handle this? I think there was an automatic, obviously, chemistry when we met. I thought he was absolutely beautiful, still do to this day. And he's not only physically extremely beautiful, you've seen him, you've met him. He's just one of the nicest people. And we were both very, very young. We're only together about a year. And it was hard, actually, because, you know, you're there with somebody who is getting all this attention, and he could probably equally say that about myself at the time. But again, because if you're in a relationship, I don't sort of tune into what's going on outside. Yeah, we just weathered itself. It took its path. It took its the path. And as I said, it's really lovely because even to this day, and I tend to be able to keep friendships with the people that I've spent a lot of time with, because that's what still works if it's there. And he's a big part of my memory for that show. And one of the many really brilliant things to come out of it, like the fans, like talking to you guys now, to know that James is out there and probably somebody who will always have my back as I would him, if you can put it that way. Regardless of where he is in the world, who he's with or whatever, there'll always be that kind of a acknowledgement of having met over something quite extraordinary. Not everyone gets to gladiate in the world. So I'm really, really grateful to it. Yeah, nice memory. Sorry, I'm going all nostalgic now.
I told you we were going to go right back there. Talking about something that kind of triggers memories, I don't know if you've seen some of the TV ads for a certain supermarket, but I just wondered, what did you think of the song? Did you choose it to be your theme tune? Or was it Nigel Lithgow? Because even now when I hear it, it takes me right back to that entrance when you were the last female gladiator introduced. The lights would go down and it would be like, here's Jet. And then the lights would come on, your eyes would light up, you'd have the leg above your head, do the spin. That music, even now, if I'm sat in a room with my mum and that music comes on, we can just make eye contact and know exactly who we're thinking of. So it must bring back some memories for you.
Yeah, it does. Just from the very beginning of the beat coming in, and I'm like, no, yes, brings back, and a really, really, really bad dancing, really bad. Yes, Devon play the leg, triple pirouette, slam down into a kind of a squat second position, and then all this stuff going on. I'm like, no, what possessed me?
We loved it. I was going to say, I've got it ready to play if you wanted to bust some moves out.
What more can I say? Here's Jet!
What more indeed. Just look at that support. A former national gymnast squad member, a professional dancer, actress and TV presenter. She's enough to make any young man turn cartwheels.
Rewinding a little bit, Di, before Gladiators in 1990, you won the role of the She-Wolf of London. And I know that's actually something that me and Paul have spoken about quite a lot, actually. He knows far more than me on this.
Yeah, you were up against 300 or 400 other girls at this audition. One of them was fellow Gladiator Scorpio, Nikki Diamond, and you both got down to the last 3 or 4 girls, I think it was. And obviously you went on to win the part. Then later on, you would go up against Nikki again in your Gladiator tryouts in 1992. So yeah, how did you find out about She-Wolf of London? How did it come about?
I think at the time, so I'd left the North to move to London to train in dance choreography. I got an agent, so I'd done a big feature film based in Germany. Louis Spence was one of the dancers with me, a few other brilliant, brilliant, good West End dancers at the time. So we were kind of like the top dancers on the scene at the time. And there was kind of like when castings would come out, you'd either see it in the stage magazine or you'd get a call from an agent, if you were lucky enough to have one, to be put up for some of these castings. And I guess Nikki Diamond, Scorpio, was on the same kind of casting circuit. And you would get to see the similar faces at various castings for TV shows, television commercials, films, TV series. I used to go up for quite a bit. I didn't always get everything. But then once you do start getting things, it tends to take on a life of its own. And I suppose GLADS was obviously the most famous and the most profile one. But before that, yeah, the guys came over from Universal Pictures from LA, Hollywood, and it was an MGM production. They were looking for the She-Wolf of London. I'll be me then. And it was based on the fabulous 80s film when American Werewolf in London was actually done. And it was the female version of that, but spliced into a TV series. So it was a great girl, American actress came over who I physically looked like. So instead of making her wolf out, they would have me to do the wolfing out bits. And the cast basically on movement ability. So I could actually move like a wolf, amongst many other things. So I could literally see an animal or watch a person and mimic them. And I still could to some degree, but I wouldn't want to. And also because my butt and my legs were quite heavily muscled. Remember I was saying I was really hung up about the way I looked as a teenager. And now people are squatting and deadlifting huge amounts of weight to get some curves on the quads and the glutes. And they needed that because obviously the whole of the upper body would have been wolf, furry wolf with the canine teeth and everything. And even the brilliant the lenses, which they'd flown over from America, which were yellow with a black mark through the middle. And at the time, they were only being used on the Star Wars set because no one was making full contact, full eye the contact lenses. So they flew over from America with a very strange man who kind of walked around with them in his little box. And I had to fit them into me. And it was a brilliant production, actually. 7 months we shot for. It taught me a lot about the discipline of TV. Long, long hours and just how a whole brilliant piece of TV, like hour-long episodes, which is what they were, came together as part of a team effort. But I think it was also part of the pre-Buffy Buffy Vampire series as well. And I think it was the same production company that probably went on to do that. So they're obviously taking mythical themes in the early 1990s to find one that would really stick and be relevant to what was going on in the zeitgeist and the kind of public psyche, I suppose. Yeah, it was really good fun, actually. It was, well paid as well.
I'd seen the transformation videos pretty recently, actually, because it was something that I'd seen as a GLAD fan. I'd seen photos, but I'd never actually seen the actual episodes until recently. And yeah, it's quite dark. The transformation was quite something. I heard that it took 4 hours to be in makeup, to be transformed into the wolf, and then still 3 hours to get back out of it again.
Yes, yes. Oh, it was hard. My agent said to me, you grab hold of your chair when I tell you how much you're going to get paid. And for a teenager, I was 19 at the time, for what was getting paid for a 6-7 month shoot contract, it was phenomenal. It let me get my first home, not buy it outright, but put a deposit down and really get on with my life as a young person. So I was very, very grateful. But he said to me, "You'll earn every penny, Di." And I thought, oh, I wonder what he means by that. So I did a lot of my own stunts because there was no very few female stunt artists at the time. Hello, Eunice. She's now one of the best female stunt artists in the world. But the stunt director, a guy called Andy Bradford, if I remember rightly, had asked me at the time, well, would I consider going on the stunt register and sticking at it? Because I was obviously doing all my own stunts. And I was like, no, I don't want to do that. But yes, it was harsh. The hardest thing was they'd stick this kind of plastic kind of canine muzzle on me and then feed over the top of it a prosthesis. So this thing that had been set in kind of a movable rubber, set into the shape and the shape of the wolf. And it was the glue they used so to make it so it would move. It was the same guy that did all the Planet of the Apes. So if you see Planet of the Apes, some of the original stuff, you can see that the face actually moves and the skin over the top to make the ape face was very, very articulate. So this thing was molded to my face. So if I moved, it would move with me and look quite realistic. That bit was okay. And yes, it would take up to 4 hours and there'd be nothing that I'd recognise about myself other than the quads and the glutes, my feet, other than the colour of my eyes. And then they're whacking those lenses. And I'm like, I don't recognise anything about myself, which wasn't a big problem at the time. But it was really weird to suddenly 4 hours later, I had my little Sony Walkman in just to kind of wend the time away a little bit and then look in the mirror and go, oh my God, it's a wolf. It really is a wolf. And it was brilliant. It was such a brilliant experience. But the worst thing was when we were taking it all off again on the other side, they used to have to use a solvent to dissolve the solvent, the glue beneath it, the prostheses, and that hurt. And it really sort of damaged my skin for quite a while because it sort of burnt you. And that was the only bad thing, really. But other than that, what a great experience. Really good experience.
And in my casting for Gladiators, we had to do an assault course and a few little gym tests. And I was against Scorpio. You know, it's really odd because I met Scorpio about 2 years before our Gladiator tryout in the casting for the She-Wolf of London. And Scorpio, myself and two other girls got down from about 300 or 400 girls to be the She-Wolf of London. I just pipped her, and I think it's because of my dance training. I could move a little bit more sinisterly or something like that. So that's how I know Scorpio. We go back a long way.
And then obviously during your Gladiators career, and particularly afterwards, you were involved with other TV shows as a co-host on the likes of kids' TV show Finders Keepers on CITV with Neil Buchanan in 1996, Saturday Night Primetime, ITV's You Bet with Darren Day, also in 96, as well as a psychologist/therapist on Channel 5's Trisha Goddard Show and Big Brother's Bit on the Side. You were also the incredibly popular games mistress on Games Master and Games World in 93 and 94. And when I was doing my research, and there are some questionable clips on YouTube of young teenage boys battling it out on computer games for a date with Jet, all whilst you were wearing this black PVC very tight costume.
It was rubber, and I used to sit just wet. Probably too much information. Wet underneath. Horrible. But it was great fun, actually, because I think David Walliams was one of the characters, and I remember meeting him a few times. Very weird. He played a very weird character. But we're all a bit weird. And that was brilliant. That was Hewland International. I think I did it for about 3 or 4 years. And the other nice thing about that, remember I said that my dad was an astronomer, might have mentioned it a few times, ever so proud, eternally proud of this amazing man. I had the privilege of calling my dad. Of course, Patrick Moore is one of our late, very famous astronomers. And I remember going on an aeroplane, and as I was with work, oh, there's Patrick. And I sat next to him and said, hello, it's Jackie Dale's daughter, Diane. He went, oh, yes, yes, as he used to do. How is Jack doing these days? And I said, great. I said, the other thing we've got in common, Patrick, is you're games master and I'm games mistress. And he had no idea what I was talking about, only that he'd done games master for many, many years. And obviously, I think games mistress had come on the back of it as a kind of sister program to the original. So that was my big link with Games Mistress, is Mr. Moore himself, Games Master. Awesome.
Hello, Games Mistress. So, how are you? Okay.
Hi, Leslie. You know, I've got a message for you.
What?
Well, it's kind of garbled. Something about thousands of Barry's fan letters being found in the rubbish or something. Leslie?
I will find Barry's letters. I have the power.
Good evening, sweethearts. If you've been wiggling away for hours till your hands are sore and you're still not getting anywhere, then give me a buzz. I'm here to help you out.
Obviously, being a co-host on some of the biggest shows around when I was a kid, like Finders Keepers and You Bet, which came after you'd hung up your Lycra and moved into presenting. How did the presenting gigs come about?
I was on an interview on Radio 5 before it became 5 Live. So originally, it was BBC Radio 1, 2, 3, classical music. 4 is topical chat and lots of good journalism, I think. I love Radio 4. But there used to be Radio 5. Now it's 5 Live, which is pretty much blanket sport and news, which is excellent. But before it became that, it was predominantly youth and education. An odd market for the BBC to try to aim at, because less and less people, even back then, early 90s, were listening to radio. TV was becoming the bigger medium and people were getting their news from those sources. So I was asked by, I was in an interview as a guest with a guy called Mark Curry, who went on to be a really good actor as well as a presenter. He'd been on Blue Peter for many years, I think. I got on really well with him and I was a guest on his show at 5 Live on Sunday mornings doing fitness with Jet. So lying, you know, so everyone under your duvet right now. And I'd literally do sort of guided exercises from people waking up on a Sunday morning, probably not the best thing. But it was one of the other producers, a lady called Elaine Hackett, had heard me one morning and she went, God, she can talk. And she's got a brain as well. And she's on popular TV. Ooh, let's train her as a presenter. So the next thing, I'm at Broadcasting House being trained how to just basically work the studio. Obviously, I hadn't learned to run the desk at that point, which came much later. And I still can now walk into a radio studio, open up a desk, fire it up and pretty much manage it, where you get producers now behind the screen doing that. But I loved all of that. So I started out as a presenter in broadcast, in radio, before anything on camera. So by the time Glanz was finishing for me, a lot of other producers around at the time had gone, well, she's a trained presenter, she can do live, she's trustworthy. And yeah, I can, could, and still could. So I loved it though. I mean, who doesn't love presenting? It's a real honour.
Also, there was a show that I believe was probably only broadcast in the Northeast, and obviously being from the Northeast, I was lucky enough to see it for Tyne Tees Television for that region, and it was called The Bodyworks, which was a weekly health magazine type show that you presented along with Cobra, Mick Wilson, in 1995. And I have such fond memories of watching this show week in, week out. It was so varied, obviously focused on health and fitness in and around the Northeast. But surely you've got some funny memories of working on that show with old Snake Hips.
Yeah, he was brilliant to work with. I think it was a guy called Peter Moth, who was a commissioning editor, director for what was then Tyne Tees, now Channel 3 Northeast or something. And he'd approached me after I'd been for a meeting up there. And he said, oh, have you got any ideas for any TV shows? I'm like, oh, yeah, a magazine health and fitness type show would be brilliant. So we did. We looked at nutrition and we shot all the way over the right through the Northeast, right there. Folk Museum, looking at nutrition from the past, all the way up to Scarborough, just any location possible. And Mickey, it was his first time presenting anything, and he was really good. He got used to get so nervous, but of course it was all pre-recorded work, and so he really got into it. And I loved the opportunity then to be in the Northeast, because I wasn't getting much time with my original family because I'd moved south and then in a very settled long-term relationship as usual. And my life was very south-centric. I had moved out of London, so I didn't get much chance to be up here with my core family. And so during that time I did, and it was really lovely. Mickey, yeah, naughty. Naughty fun boy.
So that brings us to the halfway stage of Jet Revisited. I'm not going to lie, there was probably more to it than we thought when we started this. So we decided to split this episode into 2 parts. The second part is already available. So as we used to do back in the day, stop the tape and turn it over.